The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Coming up on episode 283 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the 2023 Nissan Versa, the Lexus NX, updates to the Polestar 2. How much does it really cost to use your electric truck as your home power backup? And the all-new Mazda CX-90. All that and more coming up next. This is episode 283 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abual-Samad.
And I know you forgot. I was like ready to jump in. I am Nicole Wakelin from Let's Go with Forbes this week.
All right. And unfortunately, Robbie sent me a note a little while ago. He is not feeling well this morning. He's got a migraine, so he's gonna rest. So it's just going to be the two of us for now. We may have somebody else joining us partway through the show. If not, then we'll try and get her on at a later date. But for now, Nicole,
yes.
What have you been driving?
I'm experiencing amazing this week. I am driving the Lexus NX 350 F Sport.
So I would not have associated the phrase experiencing amazing with Lexus NX.
Well, but it says it. See right here, I'm holding it up for Sam. See on the Maroni? Lexus experience amazing.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, if it's written on the Maroni, it must be true.
Yeah, absolutely. But truthfully, not so amazing. It's okay. It's not. Here's the thing. It looks fantastic. Like it's this, and I happen to have it in this beautiful bright red. I'm trying to look up and see what the color is, but it's this like brilliant bright red color that they have. It has, because it's the F Sport, it has a sort of sportier interior, and there's red trim on the interior, and it has this very sports car-ish vibe in how it looks. The interior. Yeah, the exterior. The interior is very sporty. The exterior still has that gigantic spindle grill that I think is a love it or hate it proposition. Every time I bring it up, there's at least one person who says it's the ugliest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And then the next person says that is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Where do you stand?
You know, it depends on which vehicle it's on. I think it works better on some vehicles than on others. Like I think, you know, the way it's done on the LC coupe and convertible, I think it looks great on there. The RC is pretty good. But on most of the crossovers, I'm less enamored with it.
Yeah. Well, and this is a crossover, so it doesn't, it just makes the front of the car feel so heavy. It's so big. It's like everything just dominates in the front. I do like in the back though, how the Lexus, the word Lexus is sort of spaced out. There's a word for that spacing, but it's not centered. It's centered on the back, but it takes up longer space than it needs to. Mm-hmm. It's like spread out across the tailgate. It looks kind of cool. So it looks great. I mean, the car looks great from the, when you sit on the inside, it looks fantastic. It is comfortable. It has pretty heavy bolstering. So if you have a broader shoulders and a wider frame, you're going to find it a little bit snug. My husband found it a little tight for him because he's a tall guy. He's 6'3". He's got broader shoulders. It's a little snug for him. It was a little tight on leg room too. Like his knees sort of hit the side, like the center console on the edge of the door. There's not a lot of room if you have really long legs, but it is comfortable, assuming that you're not too big for it. It's not a big guy's car. Robbie, I feel like, would be squished in this car. I don't think he would like it as much because it's a little tight, but it is comfortable. It has a relatively smooth ride. I drove it in and out of Boston over the terrible roads currently in the Sumner Tunnel, which is like nightmare scenario because they're redoing it. And it's a road in the loosest sense of the word. And it was very smooth and handled really well over pretty bumpy, broken, chopped up pavement. Where it doesn't excel at is power. There's just not a lot of it. This has a 2.4 liter turbocharged engine with an 8-speed automatic transmission with 275 horsepower. And it just doesn't, it's not really responsive. Once you're up to speed on the highway, it's fine. It has, you know, you can easily zip in and out of cars and heavy traffic. But if you want a little extra speed, if you're going 55 and you want to go a little faster, you're going 65 and you want to go a little faster just to pass somebody who's slow or because you're trying to maneuver quickly over to an exit, it doesn't have a lot of oomph. It just is not ready to give that to you. And even getting up to that highway speed, if you mash the gas pedal in this, it's not going to set your heart racing. So it's not super responsive. Driving around town, you don't, you know, if you're in just city driving, you don't have that same kind of scenario because you're not normally taking off like crazy from a stoplight, but it's just not a very aggressive drive. So there's sort of this disconnect between the very sporty look of the interior, which is super appealing. It makes you feel like, and even saying F Sport, it makes it feel like you're getting into a sporty crossover. Excuse me. When you actually start driving it, not so much. Not so much. I did like that the infotainment screen, the Apple CarPlay takes up the full screen. I like that it goes all the way across. Some of them, it depending on the year of the infotainment system that you have and the vehicle that you have, it may or may not take up the entire infotainment screen.
Right. This goes. Sometimes it only take like 2/3 or 3/4 of it.
Right. So you, it's just the way it's like. It's that Sam territory. He could explain that. Somebody asked Sam if you want to know why, but it doesn't take up the entire screen. This one goes fully across the screen, which is kind of nice because it's great when you're following directions.
And I think it's actually a really good thing on this new, this latest generation Lexus and Toyota infotainment system, because with CarPlay or with Android Auto, you can see multiple things on there at once. So you can have your media player controls and your map on there at the same time, which with the built-in stuff, you can't. You can have your map or your media controls your other controls, but nope, not two of them at the same time.
You must make choices you do not have to make now. Yes. You can. This lets you have everything all at once. Have your cake and eat it too. So I was a fan of that. I did like how that worked. And the F-Sport adds some fun stuff, like you get paddle shifters on the steering wheel. Even the, you know, the grill and the bumper are slightly different. You get like performance dampers, which might be why I found it so smooth in those horrible, awful roads in downtown Boston. You get some other little snazzy. It's really mostly about looks and not so much about performance. I think other than the dampers, adaptive variable suspension, front and rear performance dampers, those might be the two big things that would change how it drives compared to one that wasn't the F-Sport. But again, it's not a dramatic difference. It's not like you're suddenly going to be like, oh yeah, this is a sporty little crossover. But it's fun. It was fun to drive, comfortable. It has a decent little bit of cargo room in the back seat. You know, you're not going to be moving your dresser in the back of your NX, but it does provide plenty of room for a lot of groceries. And, you know, you could bring small amounts of stuff to the dump. A couple bags of mulch you could easily fit in there, Sam. Don't need a pickup truck, probably.
With the rear seat up?
I think even with the rear seat up, if you put the mulch, I bet. Now I feel like I need to go to buy Home Depot, but who's buying mulch in January? I bet. I know you could definitely put it like lengthwise. I bet you could even put two bags of mulch, one right next to each other, straight in the back.
Okay.
So it's that's my official mulch measurement system, which I'm trademarking later. I think it's usable. It's a usable amount of space. It's more usable space than in the back of the Defender, the two-door Defender 90, that I had a few weeks back, where when you put, there was a license plate cover, and when you put that cover in like sideways, that was the entire depth of the cargo area was one license plate. I'm like, you're not using this unless you're folding the seats down. This one was bigger, weirdly, than what the Defender offered behind its rear seats.
Interesting. Yeah. So, you know, I know that the F-Sport stuff that they put on various Lexus models, you know, it's kind of equivalent to what you get like with Kia with GT line versus GT, or Ford with ST line versus ST, and you know, BMW has M, and they have their M cars and then their M Sport, which is basically you get kind of the look of the high-end performance models, but with minimal to no actual performance upgrades.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is, if you're really someone who's into performance, it is a little bit but let's hope you're going to read what you're getting when you buy a car. Yeah. But, you know, you see F-Sport and your first impulse, I would think, as a consumer is, oh, it's a sporty version. It's got extra stuff that's going to make this more power, better handling, you know, faster, more engaging, all these things. It looks that. It engages your eye more, but it doesn't engage you as a driver, I don't think, really more than the ones that are not the F-Sport. I do like how the interior looks. It's got a red interior. I'm a sucker for red interiors. It's gorgeous.
For the average Lexus buyer, for the person who's going to be interested in buying a Lexus vehicle, do you think that they would care much about the, you know, the fact that F-Sport is just kind of sporty looking versus sporty feeling?
No. For this, like if you're talking to Lexus LC or something, maybe a different Lexus buyer, maybe looking for something a little different.
Right.
But for a small, affordable, in the grand scheme of luxury crossovers, for a small, affordable crossover that's a luxury vehicle still, I think you're looking more for the style and the look of things than you are for performance. You're probably just not buying this kind of car. There's other, you know, this is just wouldn't be that. So I think the F-Sport.
Lexus has the RC, you know, right, for something that is similar price point. So you can get an RC, right, F-Sport, or you can get an RCF,
right,
you know, which has got the big honking V8 engine and, you know, it is actually fast.
Right. See, so there's other options. If you really truly are looking for something that's that performance car, the NX is just not where you're going. If you're looking for an entry level, more affordable luxury crossover, that's what you're looking for this for. And part of buying, you know, a brand like a Lexus is the, you know, sort of aura of like, I have arrived, you know, I'm buying a Lexus. I'm not buying a Toyota, I'm buying a Lexus. And that makes it a little fancier. So by adding the F-Sport package, anybody who's getting inside your car is really going to think you got it. It looks fancy. It looks, you know, it's like something special. So from that point of view, I think it's great. It's just all about style, which there's nothing really wrong with that, but it's not about performance.
Okay. And how much did the NX350 F-Sport cost?
All totaled up with everything, it was, let's see, without, it was $46,650. And then there were options on there. The F-Sport package adds $2,200, but all totaled mine was $55,325.
That's not bad.
So it's definitely luxury, you know, pricing.
For a premium compact crossover,
right?
You know, when you look at, you know, where the competition is, you look at, you know, an Audi or BMW, you know, like a BMW, like an X3, I guess would be in the right size as this, and or, you know, an Audi Q5. You know, they're going to cost at least that much.
Right. So it's not a crazy amount. Oh, and there's no one to compete with. But what do you think the destination was?
I am going to say $1,095.
Oh, you were super close. $1,075.
Oh, I was over you by almost, $20.
I know, but you were super close. So $1,075.
I was thinking $995 first. I think, nah, I'm going to go for, you know, closer to $11.
Yeah, so it is closer to 11.
Should have gone with my first instinct.
Your first instinct was the right one. But yeah, what makes it so, actually, it's not the, like I said, it's $2,200 for the F-Sport. But the other stuff that's on here, it has a bunch of upgrades. Like there's a 17-speaker Mark Levinson sound system that's a little over $1,000. They have that panoramic moonroof, that's $1,600. There's a panoramic view monitor with lane change assist and front cross traffic alert. That's $1,000. So there's a couple of expensive packages on here, you know, in addition to. So you're getting a pretty tricked out car is what I'm getting at. It's not, you know, they've added this to make this a very luxurious version of the NX. So for $55,000, I don't think it's that bad a deal if that's the kind of thing you're looking for.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I kind of had in some ways similar but opposite of the NX F-Sport. And I actually only had it for a couple of days, and I'll explain why in a minute. I had the Nissan Versa SR, the 2023 model. Mm-hmm. And so for 2023, the Versa got, you know, the current generation Versa came out in 2019, I think. And for 23, they gave it a mild facelift, mid-cycle refresh. So it's got a new mostly new front fascia, new grille, That's an updated version of Nissan's V-Motion grill that actually looks a lot more like the current generation Hyundai Elantra.
I was just thinking that, looking at it, I just pulled it up on the screen as you were talking. It does look like the Hyundai Elantra.
The face looks much more like the Elantra. And, you know, back when I first drove the current gen Versa when it came out, you know, I was surprisingly impressed with it. You know, for an entry level cheap car, I mean, you can get the Versa starting under $16,000. Mm-hmm. So if you want something that's affordable, and is also, you know, comes with a new car warranty and everything, you know, all the benefits of having a new car, you know, latest safety features and things like that. The Versa is actually a really good choice. I mean, if you don't need, you know, something really luxurious, you know, it's basic transportation, but it's very solid. It doesn't, you know, the SR is the sort of pseudo sportiest version of it, which, you know, is not saying much. I mean, it has bigger tires, bigger wheels and tires. And it has a slightly sportier look to it, especially with those wheels on it. But you know, it's not particularly sophisticated, but it does what it does quite well. You know, it's got a twist beam rear axle, so solid rear axle. You know, not no independent rear suspension, things like that. It's got drum brakes on the back, but it offers, you know, surprisingly decent handling. You know, it doesn't fall all over itself when you go around a corner. It's got decent ride quality. So, you know, given the relative simplicity of the suspension system, you know, it does a surprisingly good job of handling rough pavement. And it's funny, last week, you know, on the Friday morning, a colleague of mine who lives nearby, we were heading to a meeting in Novi. And so I picked him up, and, you know, a few minutes later, we were heading through downtown Ypsilanti. And he commented on, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, for a cheap car, this thing handles these, you know, rough Michigan pavement surprisingly well. And literally 10 seconds later,
oh no,
it hit a pothole. And immediately the low tire pressure light came on the instrument cluster. And I could hear the hissing of the air escaping from the right front tire. And so I pulled over. We swapped the tire, put on the mini spare. And when I got to where our meeting was, I sent a note to the guys at the fleet company and said, hey, you guys, you know, explained what happened, you know, hit a pothole, flat tire, put on the mini spare. Do you have a spare wheel and tire you can bring over to put on this thing? And they didn't. So they came over. They met us back at my house after we got back. And they took the car. They were going to take it to the dealer to have a new tire put on it. Unfortunately, the dealer didn't have tires in stock either. So I never ended up getting the car back.
Aww.
I had a couple of days to drive it, and mm-hmm. like I said, I've always been surprisingly impressed with this current generation. The previous generation Versa, not so much.
Yeah.
This current generation, you know, I think it's a decent looking sedan. You know, it's got the same kind of styling language that you have on the Sentra and the Altima. You know, the two next bigger sedan. Excuse me. The two next biggest sedans in the Nissan lineup, at least in North America. They don't offer a hatchback version anymore with the current generation. They used to have the Versa Note and then the Versa Sedan. The Note's gone, so it's just the four-door sedan. You know, for a relatively small car, it's got decent rear seat room. I can comfortably sit in the back seat, you know, with the front seat set to where I would want it for driving. And I'm about 5'11". So it's a very acceptable car. You know, it comes standard with a touchscreen audio radio infotainment system that has support for CarPlay and Android Auto. It has some basic ADAS features. It has adaptive cruise control, radar adaptive Ooh. Cruise control, which
wow.
on a car that costs barely over $20,000. It's very impressive.
That is.
You know, and blind spot monitoring and a few other features. It does have a CVT, and there's a 1.6 liter four-cylinder engine, 122 horsepower, 144 or 114 foot-pounds of torque. which is not much, but you know, this car is also not particularly heavy. You know, it's not, you know, this is not a sports car. You know, this is not a Nissan Z. You know, if you want a Z, buy a Z. This is your basic transportation. You know, if you have a teenager that's learning how to drive and needs some transportation, you want to buy them a new car instead of a used car because you want them to have some safety features. Or you just finished school and, you know, you want to get, you know, a new car to do your commute. You don't want to rely on, you know, the 10, 15-year-old car that you might have been driving through college. You want something reliable to get you where you need to go. Then this is a really great choice. And it's also available with a 5-speed manual, although that's only on the S trim, which is the base level trim. Mm-hmm. So if you can live without a few features, you can get this with a 5-speed and you know have some fun with it. To the degree you're going to have fun with something like this, but like I said, it's basic, but it works. You know, it does what you need basic transportation to do reliably. It's decent looking. You know, it's not hideous. You're not going to be embarrassed to drive this thing. And so I would strongly recommend this if you're looking for basic transportation and you don't insist on having a crossover. If you want a crossover or something more crossover-ish, and part of the reason I think why they dropped the Versa Note hatchback, Nissan has the Kicks, which is the same platform. It's basically mm-hmm. the same car, but it's a little bit taller with a crossover-ish looking body on it. But underneath, you know, it's got the same powertrain, the same suspension, the same brakes. It's got all the same features. So it's basically the same car.
Same car, yeah.
But and that's a couple grand more expensive. It's about $3,000 more expensive to start. So there's that if you want that. But if you like it, if you want, you know, cheap basic transportation, this is one of the cheapest cars, if not the cheapest car. I don't know. I think it might actually be cheaper than the Mitsubishi Mirage now. And I would definitely recommend this over a Mirage any day.
Oh yeah, 100%. Not even a contest.
Better looking, roomier. You know, gets decent fuel economy. So, the one that I had they didn't have a Monroney for it, but I priced it out. Let me find the page now. Here we go. Grand total, $20,745 for the SR. This is the high end version of the Versa.
And the SR, and that gets things like it has like an 8-inch touchscreen. I think I remember looking this up, right? There's a Wi-Fi hotspot. Yeah, you've got, I mean, it's not got these like fancy over the top features, but it has all the features the basic stuff that you would want. Like, okay, I've got enough. I feel like my car, I'm not sacrificing just to have a car.
Yeah.
It has the features that you want.
Even the S and the SV trims, you still get a 7-inch touchscreen audio system.
Yeah. So it's not like it's some 5-inch little dealio. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the Versa. I think I haven't driven one in a little bit, but I've driven this generation and it's a vast improvement over the prior one. And I think it exactly what you said, this is a great car if you have like a kid that's in high school or and needs their own car and you want to have them to have a new car, or a kid in college or just having graduated, or like if you're a couple or a young person and you're on a budget, but you think I need a car, I don't necessarily need a crossover. I just need a good solid car that's affordable and comfortable and has the features that I can, you know, that makes me feel like I can live with this car for years, you know, for a couple of years without feeling like, good Lord, get me out of it. The Versa is that car. It's a really solid vehicle. It proves, if you spend $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in a car, you're going to get all sorts of coolness and all sorts of things get better. But just because you can't afford that or you don't want to afford that, you can still get a decent sedan at a decent price, and that's what the Nissan Versa is.
Yeah, you know, it only weighs 2,700 pounds, so even with that, you know, the 114 horsepower is fine. It's more than adequate. It's not. You know, you're not going to win any drag races with it, but you will be able to easily accelerate, you know, down an on ramp, you know, to merge with traffic onto the highway and things like that.
Right.
With the CVT, the Xtronic CVT. It's rated at 32 miles per gallon city, 40 highway, 35 combined. I think I was getting about 32, 33 miles per gallon with it, which, you know, is great.
That's good.
You really can't complain. On the SR, you do get, you know, the 17-inch alloy wheels that are quite stylish looking. But, you know, unfortunately, if you live somewhere where the pavement is, let's say, Boston or Detroit-like, you might want to pass on the SR and go for the SV instead, the mid-level trim. You know, so with those 17-inch wheels, you get 205 50 series 17-inch tires. And those 50s, you know, the lower your tire profile, the more risk there is that you're going to damage that tire when you hit a sharp pothole or something like that.
As you have proven.
as I proved, yes. You know, the SV is on 16s with 55 series tires. So you got a little more sidewall to work with. And the S is 195, 65, 15s, which are, you know, that's probably the safest option. If you, like I say, if you live somewhere where the pavement is less than ideal.
Yes.
So definitely an excellent choice for entry-level transportation with a warranty and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia.
All right, let's dive into a few of the things that happened this week. So first off, 2024 Polestar 2 gets a mid-cycle update. And in some ways, this is a more radical mid-cycle update than you would typically find, you know, partway through a model cycle for a vehicle. You know, usually, you know, they might, you know, they'll do some slight styling changes. They might, you know, tweak the engine, give you 5 more horsepower or things like mm-hmm. that, you know, add some new features to it. And they did the slight styling update to the Polestar 2 for 2024. So instead of what looked like a traditional grill, but was not, they've replaced it with a solid panel. So it looks more like the front end of what you get on the Volvo C40 or XC40, mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's an electric vehicle, so it doesn't need that much grill area.
Right,
there.
Right.
And then the bigger change is to the powertrain, the drive system. So previously, there was a dual motor, all-wheel drive version of the Polestar 2, and a single motor. And both motors were identical, about 200 horsepower, 201 horsepower. And the dual motor, you got one at the front axle, one at the rear axle. If you got the single motor, you got just the one on the front. And it was front-wheel drive. Now, because this is an EV,
yes.
You have engineers have more flexibility to do things without necessarily having to do a huge investment, you know, in terms of retooling the vehicle and everything. So now the single for 2024, the single motor Polestar 2 is no longer front wheel drive. It's rear wheel drive,
which is a big change.
It is a big change. But at the same time, it's not that big a change because, you know, if you've already engineered it for dual motors, one at each axle, you know, it's not like you have to, you know, for a traditional front wheel drive internal combustion car, you know, usually the engine is mounted transverse, it's sideways, and you've got a transmission and everything that's driving the front wheels. And then if you had an all wheel drive version of it, you'd have to have a place for a drive shaft going down the center tunnel and all this stuff and the exhaust system. But because it's electric, now it's just, you know, you just have a motor at each end. and the motors have been changed as well. So instead of 2 identical motors that were 201 horsepower each, now they have a new rear motor that is now 300 horsepower. So you have because it's rear wheel drive, you have better handling because with the single motor, because now you don't have the front wheels trying to do steering and acceleration, which can lead to torque steer. It's better balanced. And it also comes with a slightly larger battery pack, higher capacity battery pack than it did before. So it's gone from, let's see, I got to find it now. It went from 78 kilowatt hour battery pack, which is what you still get with the dual motor setup. The long range single motor is now 82 kilowatt hours. So slightly more capacity.
And that gives you, that's a 300 mile, up to a 300 mile range. Yes, that so
the
is
range
nice.
Goes from 270 miles to 300 miles. And it also has, because the electronics are changed around, maximum DC fast charging speed is now 205 kilowatts instead of 155. So you get 299 horsepower, 361 foot-pounds of torque, 0 to 60, about 5.9 seconds.
These are there's a whole bunch of shit. Like you said, normally it's like we changed this one little thing and we made the front end look a little different. Okay. This we made it look a little different and we did this and we did it. This feels more like a welcome to the all new. Like it's very, very different than what the prior version of it was. And these improvements are all great. Like looking at this on paper, reading down this press release, I'm like, nice, 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 excellent. Like this seems like a really good improvement. It makes me want to drive this.
I'm looking forward to trying this one out. I think this will be even more fun to drive than the current Polestar 2 is.
Right.
And they still have the performance pack where you get 455 horsepower, 0 to 60 time is about 4.1 seconds. That still has, like I said, the 78 kilowatt hour battery. So you get 270 miles of range estimated. The other thing you can do if you get the dual motor, the long range dual motor, without the performance pack, you can get the performance pack as an OTA upgrade after the fact. So if you decide later on that, 420 horsepower is not quite enough for me, I need another 35 horsepower, you can do that. You can go to Polestar and say, here's my credit card number. Give me another 35 horsepower.
Take my money. Give me horsepower.
Yes. So that's the 24 Polestar 2. I'm looking forward to trying this one out. I think, it'll be a nice appetizer before we get to the Polestar 3 later in the year.
Like a little, a sign of things to come. We've done all these cool things to the Polestar 2. Just wait until the 3. Because I like Polestar and they're just... I still feel like a huge number of people, the general public, don't know what the heck this car is. Like nobody recognizes the badge. Nobody knows what it is. It sort of has that. You see that and you're like, what is that thing? Like I've had people ask me, what was this car that I saw? Like, though you saw Polestar, what the heck is that? It still doesn't have a lot of recognition as an EV brand in its own right. And I think that it would be nice if that changed because I think it's a solid car.
Yeah, no, absolutely. My only real complaint about the Polestar 2 is, I like the way it looks overall, but the belt line is really high. So when you're sitting in it, you feel like you're sitting down low in the car, sitting in a bathtub.
That's fair.
And visibility is not ideal. But aside from that, I have no other real complaints about it.
Yeah, I really like it. So I genuinely, when I read through this press release, I'm like, this is a whole new car. I'm excited to at some point, hopefully give this one a go because it's pretty slick.
All right. So let's stick with EVs for a minute.
Okay.
We've talked before about the F-150 Lightning and how Ford offers this intelligent power backup system, which was this one of the big things when they first announced the Lightning. Was it last year? Yeah, last year.
Yeah.
The intelligent power backup system includes a bi-directional charger on the vehicle, the onboard charger. So in addition to putting power into it from your house to charge the battery, you can also send power out of it to power your home if your power goes out. And so to do that, Ford supplies, when you buy the Lightning, they bundle in an 80 amp charge station, Ford Charge Station Pro, to charge the thing. And that has the bi-directional capability. And it's it actually the Charge Station Pro actually has a CCS connector on it there, not just the standard J1772, not just the AC connector, but it has the two extra large pins that when you go to a DC fast charger, that they use those for sending more power, because they use that for the bi-directional part of it. So that means that if you use the Charge Station Pro, you can't use it with other if you have a plug-in hybrid that only has that doesn't support DC fast charging, you can't use that charger with it because it doesn't have those pins on there. But you know, for any pretty much any EVs, you can use that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want to power your home, if your power goes out, you have to buy this extra box from Sunrun, which is Ford's partner on this. Sunrun does solar installations, and it's basically a transfer switch and inverter. So it's about about $4,000 for the home integration box. And so when you hook that up, then when your power goes out to your house, it will automatically flip the transfer switch, disconnect your house from the grid temporarily, and power your house from the energy in the battery of the truck until the power comes back on. Then it automatically switches back and starts recharging your truck. Cool. The guys at MotorTrend have a Lightning that they're using for a year-long long-term review. And one of their writers, Christian Seebaugh, decided to get this system hooked up in his house. So he reached out to Sunrun to get a quote. And that $4,000 for the home integration box is just for that box. That doesn't include installation.
Yeah.
And this is where the problem comes in.
This is where everything goes sideways. Very, very, very sideways.
A lot depends on your house and the state of the electrical system in your house. If you have an older house, hooking up the home power backup system could be very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And in Christian Seebaugh's case, he had a house built in the 1950s that still had a 100-amp breaker panel in the house, and he had a detached garage that had overhead power lines to provide power to the garage. Sunrun came back to him with an installation estimate of $18,000.
That's a car. That's a Versa.
Yes. Yeah. You can buy a Versa SV for that. Not even a base Versa, a mid-level Versa for 18 grand.
Right. You don't even look at a base trim. You could step up and get extra stuff.
Yeah. And the reason why, it was $18,000, like I said, the Charge Station Pro is an 80 amp charger. And a lot of older homes, you still have only 100 amp service.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to hook up an 80 amp charger to a 100 amp breaker panel, that's not going to work so well.
It's not going to work.
Basically not going to have any power left for anything else. In your house.
Nothing else is going to work.
So in order to have this system hooked up, you'd have to replace the entire panel and, upgrade to 200 amp service. That was something like $6,000 to do that.
Yeah.
Actually,
says he would upgrade the panel here. He says for an extra $7,940.
Okay, so $8,000. In this case.
Yeah.
When we bought our first house almost 30 years ago now, when we bought it, it still had a 100 amp panel in there, and I had it upgraded to a 200 amp, and I think I paid the electrician back then about $2,000.
I did mine for about the same time, and I think ours was just under two. So that was about what it cost. So pretty much the same. And now 8,000.
Well, this is in California, so
That's true.
Everything's more expensive in California. but the price of stuff has gone up too. So the other things you would have had to do is because currently has an overhead power line going from the house to the garage to supply power to the garage. They would have had to dig a trench and bury the power line to the garage, you know, and then hook everything up in the garage as well. Hook up the charger in the garage and the integration kit. So all in would have cost $18,000. And, you know, reading through this story, you know, this really is kind of a worst case scenario of what it would cost. It's hard to see how, you know, unless you had nothing but an empty lot and actually had to build the house, it's hard to, you know, this is about as much as it's possibly going to cost. So needless to say, they opted not to do this installation. But I think for, if you have a newer home, or at least if you have a home that's got 200 amp power, and your breaker panel is not, you know, and depending on where your breaker panel is physically located in the house relative to where your garage is, you know, where the truck's going to be.
Right.
You know, like in my house currently, you know, that the breaker panel is right on the inside of the wall that separates the house from the garage.
Yeah.
So it's literally drilling one hole through the wall, which is what I had the electrician do last year when I put in an outlet in the garage to charge vehicles.
Ours is literally in the garage because we have a split. So it's actually wall of the garage. So even easier, like it's just run that sucker right there. It just ran along the top of the garage and they put in a new spot for a new outlet so we could have the EV charger. But like you said, his is totally your worst case scenario. This, could it happen to you? 100%. You could have to spend $18,000 to get this installed, but you'd have to have all of these. Everything would have to go wrong. Like everything went wrong for them. If everything goes wrong, you're looking at this. Hopefully most people aren't going to have everything go wrong. You know, at least a few of these things will not be an issue for you. So like, this is a worst case scenario, but the reality is this could happen. So it's something that you really need to investigate before you buy something like this and think, well, I'm going to power my house with this. No big deal. Now you've bought it. And it's like, wait just one second. I have to pay for another car to make this power my house. You know, so it's definitely something, a cautionary tale of why you should be really sure about what the capabilities of your house as it is right now, what it requires to upgrade it to make it be able to do something like this.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you're just thinking about buying your first EV, and you want to charge at home, you know, you should definitely take a look at this, at this stuff. You know, even if you're not going to do this kind of, you know, home integration, if you just want a 240 volt outlet in your garage to plug into to charge your EV in a reasonable amount of time, you know, that, again, a lot of that is going to depend on how your house is configured. So you want, I would definitely suggest, you know, that you get an electrician to come in and give you a quote for the cost of doing this work. You know, what would it take to, you know, as kind of a baseline, just to put in a 240 volt, 50 amp circuit, just an outlet in your garage. Right. 'Cause you can buy, like I did, you know, I bought a 9.6 kilowatt charger off of Amazon for $300 and there it works fine.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and then I paid $700 to have the outlet put in there. So, you know, that's kind of the low end. Some automakers like GM now is offering free charger installation, a free charger and installation up to $1,500 value when you buy a Bolt or any of their other EVs. So, you know, look for things like that. A lot of utilities will give you a rebate, at least on the cost of the charger. But definitely, you know, before you sign to buy an EV, you know, get an electrician and figure out what you would need to do in order to support charging an EV at home.
Absolutely.
I think you'll find, you know, you might decide that, yeah, maybe right now, at least, maybe a plug-in hybrid or a regular hybrid is a better solution for you, depending on where you live, the condition of your house or the configuration of your house.
And at least it'll give you something, like if you really are sold on getting, like, I will be getting an EV, I want one. Okay, well, unless you need a car tomorrow, you know what it's going to cost to have this installed. And then you can sort of budget accordingly for, okay, this is what it's going to cost to get the car, but we need to have an extra X number of dollars here that we also need to budget in, you know, or maybe your car budget was, I don't know, $50,000. Or no, maybe our car budget needs to be 45 because five of that is going to go towards, you know, installing what I need to charge that vehicle at home. It's sort of just investigate it sooner rather than later so that you can plan accordingly. And if an EV isn't you know, if getting what you need to charge the EV is just so cost prohibitive, maybe just going with a hybrid is the right thing. You know, you don't have to buy an EV tomorrow. You can baby steps to the EV lifestyle. If it's not going to work in your current house or it's cost prohibitive, don't do it. You know, just make sure you know, make sure you investigate it. Have an electrician come. I remember our electrician coming out and talking to us about the different options, and he was great. This guy came out, it took him 15 minutes. He's like, we can put it here, here, and here. These are your options. This is your cost. If we do this, it's this much. If we do that, it's that much. I recommend this. Okay, I could get 20 estimates, but that guy gave me a pretty good feel for what it was going to cost and what I could do. That's all you need.
When you and Russ bought the Jeep, did you have a 240 volt outlet installed?
No, we had to have one. Well, we had to have one put in because we didn't have one where we needed it in the garage. So he just literally ran it in the garage to where we wanted it so that we could access it better for his car. And I think ours was, I think all told between the unit and the installation, I feel like we spent just over $1,000 to do it. Part of it was the wire, weirdly, at the time that we had it installed. You know, thanks COVID, all the supply chain issues, the particular wire that he needs to install it was stupidly expensive at the moment that we were installing. And it even said to him, he's like, do you want to wait? He's like, because prices could go up or prices could go down. He's like, but, you know, and he's like, you know, you could still have a plug-in hybrid. You could drive on gas. You could periodically charge it up. It's not like you must charge. And I said, no, just do it. Because with my luck, if I wait, it's going to quadruple in price next year. So just got it done. But even things like that can affect how much it's going to cost to install it. So it's absolutely worth just giving your friendly neighborhood electrician a call and saying, can you come out and give me an estimate and give me an idea what this is going to cost?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely always get a quote before you sign for anything.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, the Mazda CX-90. This is Mazda's new large crossover. It's replacing the CX-9 in the lineup. It is going on sale this spring. I just got back. We're recording this on Sunday, but you won't hear it before Tuesday when the embargo lifts. But I just got back from LA yesterday, where we got a preview of it, got to see it. We'll get to drive it in late March. Mazda has been very light on specific details and specs. But they have told us a few things. So for example, the size, it is longer and wider than the CX-9, which, you know, and I had a chance to talk with the chief engineer, the program manager, and the chief designer on this thing. and they explained that, you know, the biggest complaint that they had from people about the CX-9 was, you know, just its size. For a three-row crossover, it's a little narrow, a little short. The third row was really not very usable.
It was very snug. It was a beautiful car, but that was snug, and it was tough to get back there.
Right. So for the CX-90, you know, they've developed a new platform. This is their new large platform. And they also have a brand new powertrain, actually two brand new powertrains for this thing. One is already being offered in Europe on the CX-60 that debuted in Europe a few months ago. And the CX-60 is also based on this architecture, but it's shorter and narrower. We won't be getting the CX-60 here in North America. We will be getting something else. We'll be getting the CX-70 later in the year, which is, again, a little bit wider, but basically a two-row variant of the CX-90. The first new engine is called the eSky Active G 3.3-liter inline-six turbo. So it's an inline-six cylinder, as the name implies, mm-hmm. much like the new Stellantis Hurricane six-cylinder that's in the Wagoneer. Similar displacement, it's a little bit larger, actually, 3.3 liters versus 3 liters for the Stellantis. It puts out 340 horsepower, 369 foot-pounds of torque. So significantly more powerful than the 2.5-liter turbo that is currently available in the CX-9. And it's no longer transversely mounted. It's longitudinally mounted.
Mm-hmm.
It also has a mild hybrid system. It's a 48-volt mild hybrid. Unlike the 48 volt mild hybrid system that Stellantis uses on the Wrangler and on the Rams. This is not a belted starter generator system. This is more like what you get with the Mercedes-Benz and BMW mild hybrids, where the electric motor is sandwiched between the engine and the transmission. They don't say what the output of that electric motor is, but it's a 48 volt system. So it's probably going to be somewhere around 15 to 20 kilowatts. Mm-hmm. So what this will do is it'll enable, some electric assist, smoother launches when it has auto stop start. It'll be able to keep the engine off, keep the gas engine off longer. It should have notably better fuel economy as a result. And then the other powertrain option that is new to this one is a plug-in hybrid. And last week or the week before, we talked about the plug-in hybrid system that they're putting on the MX-30, mm-hmm. which uses a small Wankel rotary engine. This is not what's on this one. This is more traditional plug-in hybrid, like what you find actually in a lot of ways very similar to what's in your Jeep Wrangler. Mm-hmm. So it's got an electric motor that is sandwiched in between the engine and transmission, larger. It's a high voltage motor, larger than what's in the mild hybrid with the six cylinder. The overall combined power output of the engine and motor is 323 horsepower and the same 369 foot-pounds of torque. So slightly less horsepower, same torque as with the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, Mazda is not sharing any other details yet. They will share all the rest of those details, teasing them out over the next couple of months.
I mean, that's a nice chunk of details to start. At least they gave us a pretty good amount on the powertrains, the engines that are in there. So that's something.
I guess there are two other details that I forgot. The plug-in hybrid, instead of the six-cylinder, has the 2.5-liter four-cylinder that you find in a lot of current Mazdas.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a 17.8 kilowatt-hour battery pack. They won't tell us yet what the expected range is, but they say it's going to be competitive with the class. And when I kind of pushed them on it a little bit as to, well, what is your competitive set? They're looking at kind of more premium three-row SUVs and crossovers.
Okay.
So something like, say, the Volvo XC90 or the Audi Q7 Mercedes-Benz GLE GLE. With a 17.8 kilowatt hour battery, in this vehicle, it's reasonable. I think it's going to be reasonable to expect that it'll get somewhere between 30 and 35 miles of electric range,
which is decent.
Yeah, and that will handle most people's daily driving. Just electricity.
You could just drive around town the whole day and not, I mean, you don't ever need to use that gas, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. So we'll have more details on this coming up over the next couple of months. I said we're going to get a chance to drive it the end of March and try out both of these powertrains at that time. And then it goes on sale in the spring. They're not talking about pricing yet, but I think it's fair to assume that it's going to be a little more expensive than a CX-9.
I have to point out you missed a really important detail in this press release, Sam. So also being introduced with the CX-90 is Mazda's latest, Takum Inuri color, artisan red. There's a new Mazda red. I mean, Mazda makes the best reds on the planet. It's the am I saying that even right? Takum Inuri? It looks like that. Artisan red, I can say, but I don't, I'm feel
yeah,
like
they,
I'm...
Takumi Nuri
right. Takumi Nuri color, artisan red, and it's been developed especially to suit the CX-90 with a sophisticated yet deeply saturated color. I'm totally buying into that because I think they do the best reds.
They do, and I've long said that Soul Crystal Red is the best color in the automotive industry.
Mm-hmm.
And this is darker than Soul Crystal Red. It's more of a burgundy color. And, you know, depending on the lighting, you know, in bright sunlight, you know, you definitely see more red. And then in later in the evening, or, you know, when it gets a little darker, it's fades to almost black. So it's definitely a much darker red than Sol Crystal red, but it's still a fabulous looking color.
I think betting it's the one that they have in the photos that they've given us for the reveal. And it does have more of it. It's a deeper, darker, richer red. It looks gorgeous. I mean, these aren't even in person and the color looks just fabulous.
Yeah. For a premium, SUV, and they're definitely really focusing on the premium with this thing. There's some other interesting details on this, in addition to the color, if you look through the photos I sent you, Nicole, there's one where you can see the chief designer is holding a piece of the dashboard.
Okay.
Yeah. So one of the options, is this finish on the dashboard. It's a fabric finish, and it's got a drop stitch row in the middle of it. It looks like two separate segments, and then there's, kind of a back and forth thread going back.
It's really pretty. If that's segments. A dashboard trim, that could look really slick. I like how that looks. Mazda just does have the most amazing design team. The details that they put into their vehicles always look great. So I'm excited to see some of this live and in person, because I don't think I've ever been disappointed by a Mazda interior. They always look sort of like luxury-ish. They're always pushing that luxury territory. Like, technically not a luxury car, but dang, do they come close.
Yeah, and, the maple, the combination of this fabric covering and then the maple trim that they have in the car that they showed us really looks fabulous
together. Oh, yeah, there's a picture, I think, of the maple in there, too. Boy, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And then, because this is a little bit longer and wider than the CX-9, I climbed into the back seat, into the third row.
You did? Was it easier than the old one?
It was much easier than the old one. Easier to get in and out of. And when I was in there, I pulled the second row seat back to where it was. And, I had clearance for my knees. You sit a little bit lower than I think is ideal. I'm 5'11", long torso. My head was clearing the ceiling. I had, at least a couple inches of clearance there. So I think, at least two adults can sit back there, even though there's three seating positions. Mm-hmm. Two adults could easily sit back there without any problem. It's going to be available in 6, 7, and 8 row configurations. So you'll be able to get it with, center bench seat for three and then three kids in the back, or with center captain's chairs like they offer today on the CX-9 and three in the back, or two and two in the second row. And
do you think the three in the back would be really tight? What I'm looking at is a two in the back. It's captain's chairs in the second row and two seats in the third row. The two seats in the third look pretty comfy. Like, it looks, eyeballing it, like a decent amount of space. Do you think it was three?
I think if it's if it's kids, you could easily, three kids would have no problem back there.
Okay, but not three adults.
No, three adults, unless they're either very slim or very friendly, would probably not be real thrilled to be stuffed into that third row.
Got it.
but definitely three kids would have no problem back there.
Cool.
And even with the third row, there's also some decent amount of cargo space behind. There's a photo in here. You can see, with the third row up, you still have, there's room in there for, at least four or five suitcases, lots of gear for the beach or whatever. Because a lot of times with these sort of middle-sized three rows, if you're using the third row, you have maybe 12 inches, if you're lucky, behind that third row for cargo. This actually has a reasonable amount of cargo space back there. Yeah,
that's good. I'm looking forward to this. I always liked the CX-9. I thought it was a solid car. I've always liked it. I've driven it a couple different times. I remember driving it at the launch and thinking it was just fantastic. I really enjoyed it. So I'm happy to see what they've done going from CX-9 to CX-90. Like, what are the, to see the sort of evolution of that vehicle.
Yeah, no, I think people will be really pleased with this. I mean, obviously a lot's going to depend on how they price it.
Right.
But, you know, it'll certainly offer better performance than the CX-9. Mm-hmm. You know, the plug-in hybrid, you know, will be obviously a lot more efficient.
Right.
I think it'll be a good solution for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see that one. We'll see more of that soon. Okay. And then let's see, back to the list here. Yeah, there's another story that I wanted to talk about. We were hoping to have Kelly Funkhauser from Consumer Reports join us today, but unfortunately, she was not able to make it. So we will talk about this other story next time. They did some comparison testing of active driver assistance systems, and had some interesting results.
Yes, Sam and I don't agree with all of them. We were talking before the show. I'm like, I don't know how that got better and how that got worse. We were having an internal discussion about this is right, this is wrong.
Yeah. But I, while I was out in California, I did have a chance to interview Jeff Guyton, who is the CEO of Mazda North America. And I will include that interview after the Q&A, the listener Q&A right now, which let's answer those questions. And then
okay.
I'll have the interview with Jeff Guyton at the end. So first up from Andy C. in Discord, and also a couple people asked if you would be joining the Discord, because they'd like to see you participate in there.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I'll send you the link again.
I'm like, wait, me? I'm reading things. I'm like, it doesn't say that. Oh, wait, he's talking to me now.
Yeah, no, it wasn't in the question here. That was just something somebody else asked.
Yeah, I'll join it.
All right.
Sure.
So Andy C. asked, see, question for the podcast. My wife currently has a 2019 Kia Niro EV. We originally got an amazing lease on it when it first came out a year pre-pandemic. When the pandemic struck and we were trying to get a replacement vehicle for the last year, looked at the Kia EV6, the VW ID4, and the Hyundai Ioniq 5. She really loves the Ioniq 5, and we've been trying to get it since February 2022.
It's a year.
The issue, of course, is the astounding markups the dealers have been charging. They have been asking $8,000 to $10,000 above MSRP, which is just stupid.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Are people actually paying these astounding markups, especially with the recent loss of the tax credit for Hyundai EVs? We even hired a broker to scour California for Ioniq 5, and all he could get was one that was $5,000 or $6,000 above MSRP. And it was sold before we even replied to the broker.
Well, I think the fact that you can't find one unfortunately answers your question. Yeah, people are paying the markup. And I think if they don't have to, it's sort of a case of, well, I don't need this today. Let's wait another 6 months, next wait a year. But if you need a car, like your old car is on its way out or it's been totaled or whatever, I mean, what choice do you have? So I think they are, unfortunately, and probably very begrudgingly, paying those ridiculous markups, and that'll come back and bite dealers in the butt, though. People remember that. People don't like it, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, next week when the January sales numbers come out, we'll have to take a look and see if, you know, the changes in the incentives have had any impact on Kia and Hyundai's EV sales since they're no longer eligible.
They're such good cars, though. The Ioniq 5 and the EV6 are really good. Like, I'm trying to think if I was really hanging on for that, you know, incentive, and suddenly it went. Would that be enough to make me say no? I'm not sure it is.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, you know, Tesla's dropped their prices on the Model Y and and the Model 3. You know, Ford, you know, still has now has incentives available on their EVs on the Mach-E. So we'll see how much of any shift there is in sales over the next couple of months. Anyway, finishing off with Andy. They said, we're financially well off enough to pay off the lease, so the Niro EV is now ours, so we're no longer in a rush to get a replacement vehicle. Do you have any insight into the current car market to help us decide when would be a time to pull the trigger to start looking again? There's a lot of buzz about a potential auto sales downturn or collapse coming with the current recession and return to normal production. The car broker is still seeing very limited inventory and still well over $4,000 to $6,000 above MSRP.
Gosh, if I had a crystal ball, I think if we all had a crystal ball, we'd be telling people exactly how long to wait. I don't see this changing in the near future, but the market and how things have been going since COVID, since productions has gotten messed up, it seems to flux so much. 6 months used to seem like not a very long time. It's a long time now. Who knows what could happen by the end of the summer? You know, I don't know. What do you think, Sam? When do you think it's going to? There's
still a lot of random supply disruptions on a variety of components that are hitting plants here and there. You know, overall, things are slowly getting better, but there's still disruptions happening. You know, I was just talking to somebody the other day. There's a former plant not far from where I am here, a former Visteon plant that Ford owns the property, and you know they use it sometimes for storing vehicles. And over the last couple of years, they've been using it for storing partially finished vehicles, you know, until they get parts. And I know for the last several months, they had you know several thousand Ford Rangers sitting there.
Wow.
And I've heard from somebody that worked at the plant where they build the Rangers, you know, that they were driving the people on the line were driving them off the end of the line. They were having trouble getting seats. And so they were, you know, sticking a milk crate in there, sitting on the milk crate to drive them off the line, to put them on a truck, to bring them over to the storage lot here.
Man. Seats. It's not even chips anymore. It's like we have no seat. That's kind of a crucial component.
That's the thing. It hasn't been for a while just chips. It's all kinds of different components. You know, in some cases they can ship, like GM was shipping some trucks without the noise liner under the hood because they couldn't get that material. You know, and in that case, you know, the truck still works fine. It's easy for a dealer to install it once they get the parts.
Right.
Obviously, you can't ship a truck to a customer without a driver's seat in it.
That would probably be frowned upon by safety folks sitting on a milk carton. I don't think they'd go for that.
No, definitely not. So, you know, the combination of still some ongoing disruptions of, you know, variety of components and the fact that, you know, we've had this going on for a couple of years now means that even with a recession, you know, assuming we have a recession, even with that and some reduction in demand as a result of that, we're still going to be supply constrained and there's still pent up demand
exactly.
that hasn't been met over the last 2 years. So there's probably still going to be best case, you know, a reasonable balance between the supply and the demand for at least another year or two, maybe longer.
That's what I would think.
Now, I think, you know, we probably will see, you know, some of these markups decline and maybe just get back to selling vehicles for MSRP.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's going to be a while yet before, at least on popular models, that you can, you know, negotiate a lower price, but you'll probably be able to start getting some of these vehicles for MSRP. And, you know, maybe, you know, like with the Hyundais and Kias, because they're not eligible for the incentives, you may see dealers start to back off and start to sell them for MSRP. You know, if they're seeing customers going for other brands instead where they can get an incentive.
Yeah, so, I think with those within you know, over the coming months, literally just the coming months, like it's January. So let's say sometime by summer, dealers will really have a feel of just how much that losing those incentives are impacting their sales, and they might start easing up on those, you know, those extra, you know, amounts they're asking above MSRP. But I think overall it's going to be a long while because there are just so many things. I mean, we still get, I'm sure you do too, Sam, Monroney's that are like this, you know, credit for this because this isn't included, credit for that. There's still things. And when you go to build cars on almost every OEM site, you'll look at the car and you'll click on the trim and it'll say, you know, there's like a sort of a caveat. This is what it's supposed to be. But depending on when yours was made and, you know, check and make sure what yours is, because the one you literally get at the dealership may not have what you think it has because that day we were short on this. This day we were short on that. And they're shipping things and not hiding it, but they're shipping things with various bits and pieces not on it in the interest of, well, let's ship the car rather than have this sit here for 6 months waiting for this one little feature. Just let's remove this feature from this trim, give people a discount slightly on it so they're not paying for something they're not getting. So we're still seeing that. I don't see the demand has not gone down enough and the supply chain hasn't stabilized enough for that the extra they're charging to go down anytime soon. Hold on to the Kia Niro EV that you have for a little bit longer, I think is what we're saying.
And the other thing, that I actually did respond to Andy in Discord about this. I did a little searching here in the Midwest, you know, in Michigan and Ohio area, on inventories. And at least based on what they're posting on their websites, you know, for inventory, dealers, Hyundai dealers in Michigan and Ohio don't seem to be charging markups on the IONIQ 5. So, you know, even though you had a broker that was looking all over California, you might want to consider, you know, looking at other parts of the country. You know, obviously California is the big market for EVs in the U.S. But, you know, look outside, look a little further away. You might find it worthwhile, you know, if you can find a dealer, you know, across the country that is willing to sell you the car for sticker, you know, it might be worth spending $500 on a plane ticket to fly there
and
drive it back.
I can vouch. You can do a pretty handy road trip in a Kia EV6 if you're looking to do that. So yeah. Go fly out there, have a vacation someplace else for a couple of days and make that part of the trip driving it home again and have some fun with it. Yeah. And learn about the charging infrastructure.
Yeah. Or maybe not. All right. Last question from Jay Donsback. This was also came through from Discord. Volvo's calling their gas models mild hybrids. When does the electric assist, i.e. how do they compare with a Toyota hybrid like a RAV4? Is it just marketing smoke and mirrors? So it's not entirely smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. You do get some assist with a mild hybrid. So, you know, systems like the Toyota or Ford hybrid systems or what Honda's doing, you know, these are high voltage hybrid systems. They use high voltage batteries, anywhere from 2 to 400 volts battery systems, and more powerful electric motors, which means that they can do some driving, some limited amount of driving on electricity alone, it can also, under certain circumstances, you know, if you're driving down the highway, if it's under light load, if there's some charge in the battery, it can shut off the engine and just coast. You know, and just use the electric motor to keep you going for a while. They call that sailing mode. You can do that with these higher power, higher voltage hybrid systems, like what Toyota offers. The mild hybrids, those are 48 volt hybrid systems. So they are, it's lower voltage. So, you know, it doesn't require as many safety features, you know, to protect against electrocution as you would have with a high voltage system. It also means you have lower power motors. There's different configurations of mild hybrids. We were talking about the CX-90 earlier, Audi and BMW have mild hybrids where it's what's known as a P4 configuration, where the motor is packed between the engine and the transmission. Those can do more assist. For example, you know, one of the things you can do with that type of configuration is when the car comes to a stop, shuts off the engine, you can actually shut off the engine, you know, when you're down to about 2 or 3 miles an hour and have it shut off and be shut off for, you know, as much as several minutes, when you're sitting at an intersection. And then when you go to accelerate, it will actually start moving the car with the electric motor, and then turn on the engine when once you've hit 2 or 3 miles an hour. So when you do that, you know, that transition from engine off to engine on tends to be much smoother. It's much mm-hmm. more transparent. You don't really notice it as much. There's also the other main type of mild hybrids are using what we call a belted starter generator. It's basically a fancy alternator. It generates the power, you know, so it's driven off the engine by a belt. It can generate the electrical power that your car needs for the ignition and all your accessories and everything when you're driving. But it also has an extra idler pulley on there that allows it to actually drive that belt sometimes and put some torque, provide some torque assistance to the engine. So in the case of, for example, Stellantis on the Ram V8s, on the 5.7-liter Hemi V8, they have their e-torque system, which is this type of mild hybrid. And what it can do is the BSG will provide some torque assist to the engine And when, you know, if you're climbing a slight grade, for example, the engine also has cylinder deactivation. It can provide some assistance to allow the engine to stay in four-cylinder mode instead of switching back to eight-cylinder mode. There's different ways that they use it and configure it. The Volvo system is a BSG system, so it provides, you know, more capable auto stop start. The engine will stay off longer. When it does restart, it restarts more smoothly than a 12 volt system, and it's more transparent when it's turning on and off. And you know, it'll add a little, maybe 1 or 2 miles per gallon to your fuel economy. So it's not a lot, but you know, every little bit helps, and those systems are relatively low cost. The system that Mazda is using is a little bit more expensive, a little more capable, but it's not entirely smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, it's not like a hybrid, but it is. They are telling you something. Mild hybrid is a thing. It exists.
All right. Anything else you want to talk about today, Nicole?
That's all I got, Sam. That's it.
Well, then let's say goodbye, and make sure if you're listening, keep listening for my interview with Jeff Guyton from Mazda. We talk about kind of where Mazda is going. Did you know that Mazda actually sold more cars last year in the U.S. than they did in 2019? Despite the supply chain disruptions? Yeah.
That's kind of
unbelievable.
They had
their best sales ever.
Really? That's impressive. Yeah. Did they say? I'm shocked. I mean, I'm shocked.
Yeah, me too.
Go Mazda.
So listen to my interview with Jeff, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
All right, Jeff. So you're relatively new to this role at Mazda. And what's the overall philosophy around the CX-90? What were you trying to do differently with CX-90 compared to CX-9, and how were you trying to evolve in the segment?
Okay, so CX-9, I personally think CX-9 is a great driving car, and has many great characteristics, but for the U.S. market, the knock on it was always that the package was too small. And so obviously we needed to remedy that. And having said that, 2022 was the best sales year for CX-9 ever. But it still didn't reach the kind of share and the kind of presence that we have with CX-5 or even CX-30 in their respective segments. Partly because of the package space, partly because of power, or at least the perception of power. I never felt like CX-9 was underpowered, but there is that. And also, in that segment, there's a great deal of importance on towing. So we addressed the power, the towing, and the package with CX-90, with that all-new platform and those new powertrains.
So CX-90, is that going to be a North America-only vehicle, or is that going to be a global vehicle?
So CX-90 itself will be focused on North America and selected other markets where the roads and the parking spaces and all of that fit well with that product. There are four brothers on that large platform, 60, 70, 80, 90. And the 60 has gone on sale in Europe and Japan. It is dimensionally narrower and shorter than CX-90, and it's a two-row product. That's the right dimensions for those markets, whereas 90 and what will be 70 will be the right dimensions for the U.S.
So 70 something that's also coming to North America?
70 will come to North America.
Okay. In determining kind of what powertrains to put in here, both new powertrains, the six-cylinder and the plug-in hybrid, are both significantly more powerful, a lot more torque than what you had before.
Yes.
What was the thinking there in making those decisions? And in 2023, doing an all-new six-cylinder engine like that, some might consider an unusual choice, given where a lot of the market's going right now.
I think the six-cylinder allowed us to do several things. One, it allowed us to have a competitive level of power. as well gave us the capability to tow. The layout also gave us the space to build in the plug-in. So within the length, it's obviously got the four-cylinder in front of the plug-in technology, but overall that package gave us the space to put in the i6 and offer that power and towing.
So the four-cylinder is mounted a little bit more forward, like towards where the front of where the six would be?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Well, you can ask Wakie-san, but that's my understanding. It's there, and then the plug-in hybrid motor sits behind and between the engine and the transmission.
Okay.
Well,
I guess why an inline six as opposed to a V6?
Well, what we can see is that the i6 has really perfect balance. And it also afforded us a number of advantages in the platform, in the way that we package the suspension, in the steering angle that we can afford with that as well, so that it's more maneuverable. There you go.
So what do you see as the competitive set for CX-90? You know, over the last half dozen years or so, you know, Mazda as a brand, at least in North America, has shifted upmarket, yeah, you know, to a much more premium,
sure,
kind of, you know, mainstream premium or premium, from where it was. And who are you targeting with a car like CX-90?
You know, for different attributes, we look at different competitors rather than a single competitor. And what I'm really focused on is being relevant and competitive in the segment and hopefully taking an unfair share of that total segment, which is not quite as large as the compact segment where CX-5 sits, but it's still pretty big and it's growing. And so having a really competitive entry in there, hopefully we take share from lots of people.
I guess where I'm really getting at is, what is that segment for the CX-90? Is it the likes of Hyundai Palisade, Kia Telluride, or is it even, you know, maybe aspirational, a little further up market to something like Volvo XC90?
Well, I think the customers in that segment look at lots of entries, and so we're going to try to appeal to a broad spectrum.
Okay. You mentioned earlier, you know, that 2022 actually sold more vehicles than you did in 2019,
yes,
pre-pandemic in North America, which I think is pretty much unique in the industry.
There's only a handful.
Yeah. What did Mazda do? You know, how was Mazda able to achieve that when everybody else was struggling to get parts, you know, as a relatively smaller player?
Well, I mean, you know, we struggled too. But what we were able to do, there are several things going on, right? One, and I talked about the upgrades to our dealer network. But what's more important maybe than the facilities themselves is how that has improved the relationship between the dealers and the brand. It has never been stronger, both quantitatively and qualitatively. The surveys we see and so forth, dealers are very optimistic about the value of their franchise and the relationship with the brand. And what that has done, and part of the reason for that, has been that through the course of the pandemic, we really tried very hard to improve the communication. And that sounds like some words, but, you know, if you go talk to Jimmy Shearer, who is the chairman of our dealer council, you know, I think he would probably say that that he has not experienced that kind of communication with other manufacturers. So when it was good news, we told them good news. When it was bad news, we told them the bad news. And we kept up a regular dialogue so they knew what was coming. They knew what was going to be on their lots, and so they could prepare and turn over vehicles very quickly for customers. So they were able to make the most out of the, be it constrained, supply we could give them.
So it sounds like transparency between Mazda and its dealer network was, yes, was a key. One of the, you know, one of the big things...
I mean, there are other factors too, well, yeah, but that's... Yeah. Yeah.
One of the interesting things, you know, over the last 3 years, you know, as we went through lockdown and post-lockdown period, a lot of automakers were trying to push to more of an online sales model, trying to digitize the whole sales process. And you know, other, you know, even before the pandemic, you know, we've seen manufacturers experiment with some different models, you know, trying to do some things around subscription. Mm-hmm. What if anything is Mazda doing, and you know, kind of what are you looking at to evolve the sales experience for your customers and for your dealers?
Yeah. So, probably every manufacturer you talk to talks about omnichannel. But for us, you know, we want to enable a sale to a customer the way they want to do it. Having said that, we still believe that there's great value provided by our newly outstanding dealer network to provide service and the face of Mazda, trust in the brand, availability for any problems that might happen, and so forth, so that we can enable a digital sales experience. People can configure the vehicle. People can find out how much it's going to cost. People can find out what inventory is available. But in our experience, people also want to be able to trust that they can reach out to somebody and get a problem fixed or understand the new technology in the car or whatever. And that peace of mind, if you have a good dealer network, then that peace of mind is valuable.
Trusting dealers is something that seems to become much harder for a lot of consumers over the last couple of years. Because of constrained supplies, we've seen dealers doing a lot of shady things, dealer markups, selling cars out from under a customer to somebody else. Has Mazda experienced your network?
What I would say, at least the feedback that we've had, is that our encouragement of the network to focus on the loyalty opportunity going forward. So we have a lot of new product right now. We have a huge investment in the dealer network, and it's good. We have a new financial services provider, which is also really good. So there's a lot of opportunity to build a really good business here. And our coaching was, let's invest for the long term. That's what we're all doing. So don't be doing, as you said, shady things. Don't be doing shady things today that mean that the customer isn't coming back to you the next time. So keep your eye on that, guys. And they, I think, responding to the transparency and other things, the relationship with the brand, I think their behavior has been pretty good. That's the feedback I've had.
Okay. Looking forward, as you get more and more electrified, you've got the MX-30 out there that you've had limited volume in California. Now, presumably, the plug-in hybrid CX-90 will be considerably more available than that one was. Mm-hmm. And down the road, as you have other electrified products, whether they're plug-in hybrids or battery electric, mm-hmm. One of the challenges for traditional dealers is education, and getting them prepared to deal with these vehicles and help their customers understand, and make the right decision for, you know, for what that customer actually needs to pick the right solution for their needs. How's Mazda working with its dealers to get them ready for the future?
So we have, internally, we have, we talk about three phases to our electrification program. This is the first. The end point, obviously, will be a kind of skateboard platform, dedicated EV architecture, and so forth. And our dealers are going on the same journey. So almost, I would say, practically every dealer across the country is prepared for plug-in CX-90. And they've had the training, or are getting the training right now, because we'll be on sale in the spring. They get the training. The facilities are in place for this kind of electric product. And the relative penetration that it will have in the portfolio, so they're ready for that, to be able to guide people. Do you want a more traditional gasoline engine? Are you ready for an electrified product like a plug-in and so forth? They've got that. So we're not running past our blockers, if you will, on that one. And I think they're in pretty good shape.
Okay. With technology in general, automotive technology in general, one of the things that I've seen and I've heard from other people, is the dealer, one of the problems that we've long had with dealers in the U.S. or North America is a lot of turnover among the retail staff.
Yes.
It's hard to get retail people to explain to customers what the technology is in a vehicle, whether it's the propulsion system or, the safety systems in the car. And, people drive away with their new vehicle. They don't necessarily really understand what they've got. And are you trying to get your dealers, better trained to understand the full spectrum of the technology in the vehicles they're selling?
Yes, and so there's quite a huge effort in our shop to do that, and actually, a number of years ago, we started a dedicated team for training people about brand and product. So it was and culture. So it's really very much integrated across all of those things. And we have a quite robust platform for training our staff, including even gamification among the network to get people ready for explaining all of those new things. Turnover is clearly an issue in the industry, but what we understand is that people who come to work in those now RE retail evolution facilities, they feel different. And they are much more engaged with the Mazda brand than ever before. So we see the satisfaction with their efforts quite high.
Do you have a estimate of what percentage of CX-90s you expect will be plug-in hybrid versus the six-cylinder?
You know, it's a moving target, but I'm guessing about 20%.
Okay. And is that going to be available nationally or regionally?
Yes, nationally. I do expect, obviously, much greater penetration in California and less in
Wyoming.
Other states.
Okay. Anything else about Mazda, what it's doing today, where it's going in the next few years, kind of what your overall philosophy for the brand is, or the products that we should be thinking about?
I think, if I come back quite philosophical now, where we want to go as a brand and where we want people to think initially internally, but then hopefully externally also, is, and I want to enrich the lives of those we serve. And there's a lot in that statement for people, because I want the service aspect, and I don't mean fix it when it's wrong.
Okay.
I mean, we serve people. And I want to make them feel good. I want to enrich them. And I can enrich them through great design. I can enrich them through safety, dedication to safety. I can enrich them through various bits of technology. I can also be a partner in local communities. And we've taken some steps in that area. A few years ago, during the pandemic, we offered oil changes to healthcare workers, regardless of what brand, for free. We had more than 50,000 people come. Three quarters of them were not Mazda customers. So they came, they had a great experience with Mazda. Hopefully, we gave them something that was valuable to them. But they saw us for the first time. I think that's important. Not only as a promotion, but as something warm-hearted. And we want to do a lot more in that space going forward. So this umbrella of enrich the lives of those we serve is not just about the product and not just about the dealership experience, but it goes further than that. So, yes, we expect to grow our sales. Yes, we expect to make money and all of those things. But this aspect is something I want to see grow in this market.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to talk with you.
Great conversation.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.